Hello and welcome to Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. And this could be our last Zoom one because in theory we might be able to meet at some point in the future, which is going to be lovely because I miss Susie's gory locks.
How dare you?
Well, I'm very excited about the idea of actually sitting in the same place as you. Nearly as excited as I am to actually be able to sit indoors today. Although it is the most glorious day, you won't be hearing birdsong and raven squawk because I've actually found a way of making the internet work sufficiently indoors. And it is cold outside today, although beautiful.
It's a result.
It is.
It's a result. I wanted to ask you, I'm really, really fascinated about how you learnt your shamanic ways. I know you prefer to call them witchy ways in a way, but I know you were sort of born a witch and you come from a family, an Irish family that are witchy. But how do you learn this stuff? Who teaches you? Does it come in empowered, you receive it, or do you have to have the discipline of learning? And the opposite, of course, is seminary, which is totally what we would call Hodian in Kabbalah, which is intellect and turns more people into atheists than it helps. So, presumably.
Okay, first of all, can I just address the idea that I come from a witchy family? My family, were, if they were to listen to that comment, would be appalled and up in arms. They are a family of mostly practicing Roman Catholics, but the kind of witchy element is that my grandparents, both of them, so my mother's parents, were the single most open-minded, open-hearted people you could ever, ever hope to come across. And along with much of the population of Ireland, whilst being Catholic, are also incredibly proud of their Celtic heritage and their ancient heritage. And, you know, it's no mystery why the Irish have kind of adopted that wonderful ancient being Brigid and turned her into Saint Brigid, because they are very much, it seems to me, as a, you know, an outsider, I was born and raised in England, a people who are very, very in love with their land and their history, and their connection to the ancestors, or certainly in my family, the connection to the ancestors was really overt. And I have the enormous good fortune that my grandfather, so my mother's father, his mother, her sister and her two brothers lived for a while on the farm upon which Newgrange stands. And so that incredibly ancient, I think it's Neolithic, mound and passage tomb was their playground. And in fact, their initials, the two boys, their initials are both proud and appalled to say, are part of what's engraved in the stone when you get into the chamber. And so this idea of love of land, connection with land, was absolutely instilled into me. My grandfather grew pretty much every vegetable the family ever ate and was, in his heart, above all other things, a farmer, although he didn't own a farm, I don't think, or certainly not at the point I knew him. He didn't have a farm. No, he did have a farm earlier on, but not when I was around. But so love of the land was absolutely fundamental to this family. And then his mother and my grandmother's aunt were both absolutely extraordinary psychics, amazing. So there are family tale after family tale, all about how something like Granny Vi, for example, was waving goodbye to some people who were boarding a boat for India, or I can't remember, it might not be India, but anyway, let's call it India for now. And she was waving goodbye to them on the gangplank, as I understand it, and suddenly she's grabbing them by the arm and saying, this is urgent, when you're in Marseille, you must not lock your hotel door. And they were sort of patting her arm and going, don't worry, dear, we're not going anywhere near Marseille. That's not the way that this boat goes. And she was, you know, fiercely looking at them and sort of wagging her finger and going, just make sure if and when you are in Marseille, you do not lock your hotel doors. Well, something went wrong with the boat. It got redirected. It stopped in Marseille. All the passengers had to be unloaded. They were put in a hotel. They went to bed. They locked their door. And then this woman suddenly remembered, oh no, Vi said don't lock the door. So she got out of bed and she unlocked the door. And in the night, the hotel burned to the ground. And the only people who were saved were mostly members of staff, those who had not locked their doors, and the rest of them were overcome by smoke. And so, you know, those kind of stories. And they just made, within my family, they made it totally normal to know the unknowable and to love the land, and to believe that all good gifts come from the land. You know, I would have been told probably that they came from God, but I would have seen on a regular basis that they came from the land. Here's lunch, it comes from the land. And that to me is one of the reasons why we are less and less witchy, to coin a phrase, in our ways, because we've forgotten that food comes from the land. To us, it comes from Sainsbury's or wherever. I think I've done this before, haven't I? Apologies.
No.
A supermarket which shall remain nameless and not sponsored by...
Other supermarkets may be denigrated later. It's fascinating because I grew up in Birmingham in an urban environment in a very locked down emotionally family. And food did come from the shops, but I went shopping with my mother. It was local shops. And even so, I still had some urge to be witchy. My mother used to read me wonderful books, and I'm so grateful she read me The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Googe, which is actually Christian magic, i.e. there's a vicar in there, but it's all magic of the land. And I always had this yearning, so I think part of me envies you, the childhood you must have had, because to have had that level of openness must have been marvellous. But then, hey, I've kind of got there in the end. So how did you learn?
So from the aforementioned listening to the land and listening to the ancestors. So I guess from direct experience. So as a child, I saw, in inverted commas, so I often saw those beings that culturally we call ghosts. And I also saw, to a degree, what you could kind of say was really happening, if you like. So it took me too long, frankly, but years and years and years. I think I was probably even in my 20s, actually, when I finally figured out that what people thought they were saying and what other people heard wasn't the same thing as what I heard when people speak. And that over and over again as a child, I was thrashed for things like spying or kind of, you know, listening at keyholes or just generally being in possession of information that I wasn't supposed to have, or for being what was described as cheeky, because I would say things that I felt or, you know, knew to be true based on what I had heard or seen. And the people in question didn't think that they'd owned up to whatever it was that I was hearing or seeing. And therefore, I must have got my information from somewhere else or, you know, have been listening at keyholes, which I absolutely was not doing. Mm-hmm. And it took me so long to figure out, okay, I think maybe I even heard different words. I do not know. But...
Oh, that is interesting. And again, I can relate to that. Now I know it's because my husband's an astrologer and I know that I have moon in Scorpio, which is in its detriment. It's not an easy place to have your moon. Your moon represents your ego or your way of seeing the normal.
Mm.
And Scorpio goes underneath. And I do, when I learned healing, I learned with the National Federation of Spiritual Healers, as it was back then, many years ago, I wanted to see auras.
Mm.
And I started to see auras, and within a week I said, I don't want to see auras anymore. This is totally intrusive and very, very painful, because you don't just see the pretty, pretty.
Yeah, yeah. I used to see auras too and ask for it to be shut down.
Yeah. And also, one of the gifts of a prominent Scorpio in your chart, if you want to call it a gift, is you can tell when people are lying. And you also know exactly why they are lying. So there's no blame involved in it. It's interest. That's a defence about this and that. And also, I've got that from personal experience, because my mother was agoraphobic and had other mental health problems, which weren't acknowledged way back in the 60s. And I was taught, not you must lie, but I was taught by the experiences of my life that I had to cover up for a perfect codependence, you know, which had to be grown out of. But I became a very scorpionic liar. Scorpios tell the truth to hide the truth.
I don't know if you know, but you are addressing a Scorpio.
This is the moon, dear. Oh, that was my mother's tone of voice, wasn't it? It was meant to be said with a little bit of humour, but when it came from her, it didn't have the humour. No, the moon is in the detriment. The Scorpio moon sun is fantastic.
Oh, good. Tell me more.
But that's interesting. It's coming to the same place from a different direction, but I'm far less skilled in this than you are. So did you have any formal training, or did it just sort of seep into you all your life?
I've had two kind of bouts, if you like, of formal training. I mean, to a degree, it seeped into me. And as with so many things in my life, I was kind of coerced into doing something really with, you know, a kind of spirity hand firmly pressed into the small of my back going, you will go this way. And I don't know that I put up a huge amount of resistance, but I tend to look around after a little while and go, oh, I'm over here. Okay. So what happened was, having been this, you know, witchy kid who was always, everywhere I went, I managed to acquire the nickname witch, which, you know, at the time, obviously I didn't like. It's taken me, well, 4 or 5 decades to be content to be called a witch, and only really when I found out where it comes from and what it truly means, which I'm in the process of reading the single most fascinating book ever, which I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the title of, which suggests that the word witch originally comes from the name of one of the most ancient tribes of these lands, who, interestingly, actually are the tribe from the place where I was born. I was born in Cirencester. And that in their understanding of the word, hrikka, it means sacred vessel. Now that I can stand in. That's beautiful. And that's how I feel, you know, potentially the being in a woman's body to be. We can be a sacred vessel. So yes, absolutely. I now stand up to being a witch. But when I was 5 and being called a witch by my playmates in the schoolyard, I wasn't super impressed. They didn't mean it kindly. And so I spent my childhood probably just feeling bullied by it, and also maybe on some level acknowledging that it was probably true, but I didn't really know what to do about it. Then briefly in my, not late teens, maybe early 20s, I just thought, right, sod this. I'm not having anything more to do with this. And as you do, went off to London to try and do the whole big city thing. Managed, I think I was there for about 2.5 years before I thought, what am I doing here? This is awful. I don't like anything about being here. And came home to Devon. And then reasonably hard upon the heels of that, met a woman, a lovely woman, who is still both my dearest friend and I consider her a mentor, who had a son who was very, very ill. He'd got some kind of growth on the back of his neck, aged 8, and aged 15 was in a wheelchair and, you know, very, very ill. And she, upon our meeting and getting to know one another, decided that I really needed to meet this young man and that he really needed to meet me. And we just got on like a house on fire straight away. And he said to me, oh, he was extraordinary, off the scale kind of psychic healing being, just amazing. And within, I don't know, 5 minutes of meeting, he went, oh, you're going to be my healer. And I went, I'm not. I don't know how to do that. And he went, no, no, you really are. We're going to work together. It'll be fun. What do you do? What do you see? What do you know? And I said, well, I see things in people's auras. And he went, great. Okay, brilliant. We'll start from there. And so we met, I think we met every week. I would go round there and we would sit together and I would tell him what I saw in his aura. And then the two of us would figure out, was it good? Was it bad? Did it need to be there? My sense would be that's yucky or that's beautiful or it needs to move or whatever. And between us, we would move it or transform it or take it away or whatever.
Where do you send it to? Sorry, I'm fascinated by this story, but I want to know when you take something from somebody, where does it go?
So I have a very, very literal personal mythology, which has, been created over years. And so for me, it goes into a massive cauldron. And the cauldron belongs to kind of both Bran and the Morrigan. So those are both crow god beings, yes, if you like. And they transmute it into, from something that doesn't belong, it's returned either to where it does belong, if that's appropriate, or it's sent kind of into the uncreate, into the void, if that's appropriate, or it is held. The most easy way I can describe it is kind of by something maybe akin to angels. If what we're carrying around is a part of another person. So if I gave you my heart,
yes,
that's actually not a good thing, because then you have to carry around my heart and I haven't got my heart or some of it. And that benefits neither of us. I am disempowered and you are carrying luggage. But it's not, although it's right for me to take it from you if you don't want to carry it as the healer, it's not right for me to return it to the person who gave it to you unless they're asking for it. And so it needs to be looked after in a place of, safety, beauty, outside of time.
Right, almost like a Horcrux in Harry Potter. I mean, that was used as a very negative thing, but you've talked earlier about parts of your soul leaving or going to a safe space when a time of trauma comes. Mm. So what Voldemort did, and that was the evil side of it, was take parts of his own soul and hide them so that he couldn't be killed. So they had to find them all.
Yeah.
So it's the same magic. It's just a different aspect of the same magic, yes?
Similar, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't read Harry Potter closely enough, I'm afraid.
Fair enough. But back to, there you were with this young man, and what happened?
We transformed his energy field over a number of years. And he'd arrived at the point where it really seemed clear to him that, I mean, I'm saying this in retrospect, at the time it was awful. It was really, really clear to him that his choice was get up and walk or die. Mm. And he chose to die. And he, as far as, retrospect and the things his mother says and what was felt at the time in conversations that I didn't know about, that was the right choice for him. And he felt that he'd come here to do all this, clearing and teach lots of people lots of things, and that dying was appropriate. And to me, that meant that as his, in inverted commas, healer, I had failed in the most fundamental and miserable way imaginable. And so when at his funeral, his mother was insisting on introducing me as, this is Susie, she's Harry's healer, I just wanted the ground to swallow me up.
Yes.
Because I didn't understand that healing is the journey to wholeness, and the ultimate version of wholeness is when we return to the whole of the divine. And that so ultimately, every one of us, our journey is towards death. The only certainties in life are change and death.
Absolutely, and we assume that we have the right to live to 90 or whatever, and we don't.
Not necessarily.
No. Yeah. If we come in for specific purpose, perhaps, and if we do have come in for a specific purpose and we do that, then that's our job done. One of the reasons why I like religion is that it is absolutely certain that there is more afterwards, and I'm sure that you agree. Of course you do. There is life afterwards. You don't necessarily have to earn it through good deeds or anything like that, because everybody goes on. And we don't want to leave here because it's lovely, but of course many people do want to leave here because it's horrible. So death is not wrong. It's the people who are left behind who are the ones who give it the difficult aspects. To tell me though, did you feel, can you discriminate between whether you felt guilt that he died or shame? Because Brené Brown describes the difference between them in a way that made me go, yes! You know how you just get one of those things that makes you go, she says, guilt is for things that you did that you think are wrong. And shame is because you actually believe that you fundamentally as a being are somehow wrong.
Oh, wow, gosh. Yeah, I'm liking that. I keep hearing about Brené Brown, but I've never... Do you read her? Do you listen to her?
I've got one of her audiobooks, which... channeling my mother. She speaks too fast in an American accent, so if I listen to it, I have to turn her down half a tone to 75% of her speed. So I would prefer to read her, but she's got a wonderful TED talk on shame. So just look up Brené Brown and shame, and just that talk will tell you whether you love her or not.
Okay, cool. Just addressing shame for a minute, because I think it's a very, very, very powerful force in our culture.
It's a demon.
There's and a wonderful book also called... I'm so bad at remembering books.
Susan's going to message me the names of these books and I'm going to put them up in the,
well
in the
done.
Link.
So it's called... I think it's called... The Wild Feminine by Lucy Pierce. It's definitely by Lucy Pierce. And it examines shame at length. And is amazing and basically says as soon as you out it, you're free from it. As soon as you name that of which you are ashamed, you are freed from shame. So yes, I think I felt perhaps shame, I don't know, mortification was how I would have named it at the time. I was just mortified. But anyway, everybody else insisted that this was the right thing, and slowly over time I came to see, okay, I get it, that a healing journey can be to death. Of course it can, you know. And so following that, I did a training in Reiki, because that was all the rage back then, and you know, Reiki was the acceptable face of energy healing, and I masqueraded as a Reiki practitioner for a while, which actually I do feel shameful because I was so not doing Reiki. You know, I learned the word and I did learn how to do it, but you know, I was still doing what I now know is called shamanism, which I didn't know then. I had heard of shamanism, but I didn't really know what it was. And then I went and did a practitioner training. And within the context of that practitioner training was suddenly there was all this, you know, like, here's this thing called soul retrieval. Here's this thing called extraction. Here's this creature called a power animal. I was like, oh, it's a thing. All the things that I've been doing all this time, they've
got
names.
Via Reiki.
No.
I was going to say, I've never heard of that in Reiki.
No. This is from a shamanic practitioner training.
Yes.
And that... I discovered this worldwide community of people doing the very same things that I was doing. And that then, up until that point, I had been very quiet indeed about what I did. And I kind of came out from my closet once I had the language to describe what I did and started kind of, I guess, reasonably publicly owning up to, okay, here's what I do, here's how you can find me. It took a long time.
It's fascinating you use that word mortified, because mortified comes from mort, death.
Mm-hmm.
So you, in a way, part of you died, and that's the mortido of the alchemist with the crow. The level of the crow. Some part of you had to die And the probably the part of you that thought that all healing led to life was the part that had to die.
Well, and I imagine also, I mean, that makes such perfect sense. But also the part of me, perhaps, that believed that I, Susie Crockford, could make any difference to anything. And the part of me that believed that I should succeed, in inverted commas, and that somehow death was failure.
Mm.
And that if you're going to undertake healing on behalf of the spirits and, you know, be the facilitator of that healing, you've got to be damn sure that it's not you doing it, that it's got nothing to do with you. You are the holder of intention, the carrier of a thread on behalf of the spirits. You don't do diddly squat. I do not do diddly squat, except hold an intention, bang a drum, provide a beautiful room and a comfy place to lie down for the people who come to visit. And it's, you know, if anybody believes that they, the human them, are a healer or doing healing, then they need to take a long, hard look in the face of mortification, frankly.
Just yesterday, I had an example of that. I was talking to a friend on Facebook. She posted something that she has been quite ill and made a miraculous recovery, but it was something she posted, and my Scorpio moon went, that's not true, and sent her a message saying, are you okay? And she came back and said, oh, God, no, I'm not. There's this, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, would you like me to send you some healing? And she said, oh, God, yes, please. And I had every intention of doing it when I was in the bath that night. And because I had a really busy day yesterday and I wasn't going to manage to stop and do it. I probably should have stopped and do it. But I knew I was going to do it because I do healing in the bath anyway. 7 o'clock at night, which is at least 3 hours before my bath, I get a message back. She said, oh, my God, Maggie, what did you do? It's amazing. I just feel it's fantastic. The whole thing's sorted. The phone call's been made. Oh, my God. It's fantastic. And I'm going, yeah, that wasn't me.
No.
But I knew I still had to do my bit later in the bath, even though the healing had been received, because I had to be the grounding for whatever it was that had been given.
Well, and also, actually, that speaks to me, the fundamental, literally the fundamental aspect of healing, which is the willingness of the recipient to receive.
Yes.
And that when we say yes to healing, no matter who it is we're saying yes to in human form, a kind of massive light goes on in the etheric that goes, I am up for it. I am ready.
Yes.
Bring me back my me to me. Take from me that which doesn't belong.
Yes. Yes. We have my bishop is an alchemist and a Kabbalist and an amazing man who wrote a book called Sacred Magic of the Angels, which is about how to align prayer in the right way through an angelic, through a spirit, you would say. For example, Raphael for healing, or Sashiel for prosperity, or Samael for protection. That's not Satan, it's Samael, angel of Camael, sword of God, fire of God, poison of God. You have to be very careful what you do with these things, and I've just lost my thread because I went round in circles with that and I was explaining too much. But the thing about it, I think, is that you have to very clearly state your intention. You have to do it in a foreign alphabet. So you have to sit down and meditate and be with yourself and ask. And you will get one of a certain level of signs, certain specific signs, if the petition is granted. And if the petition isn't granted, it's a message that you have to do more to clear the airways for that prayer to be able to get through. Because once the prayer is through, it will be granted. But something is blocking you on the way there. So that comes back to the perhaps not being ready for it. And when I went through the cancer journey, I was writing letters for help. And one of the signs for a Raphael healing is a bird to enter your house. And I wrote the letter in all the correct language with the candle and the meditation. And then I went out on a porch and a swallow flew into my face and its wing touched my forehead. And I thought that was yes. But of course it wasn't, because it wasn't in the house. It was in the porch, and it's an open porch. But it gave me hope. And it was the most beautiful message, because what it actually said, how my bishop interpreted it, was the message was, we hear you, we are working with you, there is more to do.
Okay. I'm very intrigued. What's with the foreign alphabet? Why do you need to write in a foreign alphabet?
Well, it's like an awful lot of things with ritual. It's to focus you down. A spirit doesn't need you to write in a foreign alphabet.
Mm.
But if you are going to have to write in a foreign alphabet, one, you're going to be absolutely focused on getting it right. And two, you're going to make it as short as you possibly can. But that's really it. And in fact, the only prayer we're meant to send to Raphael is, may this be for good purpose or swiftly pass away.
Mm. Ooh, I like that.
You know, have I got something to learn from this? And will you help me learn from it? Or can you take it away?
Mm.
Which again comes back to what you said earlier. It was, does this belong to me, or should it be with me, or should it not be with me? And I've got a lovely friend called Deb Rowley. Do find her on Facebook. She's a darling. She's in New Zealand. And she's sort of my co-counsellor in healing aspects. She comes to me if she needs a little clarity from something that she's doing in New Zealand or all over the world, and vice versa. And again, I lost my thread. It's one of those days, isn't it?
It's one of those days, yeah.
But I think it's actually about having the detachment.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to this idea of, if the healer thinks that they're doing it, they're attached. And if you're trying to work with your dog, I mean, I've been talking to you about one of my dogs. Hopefully next week you'll be able to see her, and you'll be able to put your hands on her, and then you'll probably know. But maybe you'll know already what she needs. You've already given me some very good advice.
I hope it turns out to be good advice.
But I think it's really important to have that level of detachment when working in, certainly with the communion service, for example. It's a ritual that just brings you to you.
Mm.
It's not about having to say it perfectly and put your arms up in the right place and do the cross in the right way, though those are part of the ritual, because the angelic presences, the spirits, know the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Once you robe up in the right way, if you just say, this is my livery of service, it's a magnificent livery of service because I serve something magnificent. I'm a scruffy bugger the rest of the time. But I will wash and put on the livery to be the butler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be the expression of this ancient ceremony that is on the pattern that was given to Moses, apparently, in the Bible. The modern communion service since the end of the Tridentine Mass has broken slightly from that, and that might be one of the reasons why a lot of the good power in religion may have dissipated. But I work with the structure of the Tridentine, and you do a Mass. It's darned hard work doing a Mass. The robes are heavy.
They look heavy, yeah.
They certainly make you very grounded. And what you're really doing, I presume, and most Christians would be offended by this, you are weaving the magical fabric to clear the air for the presence to be there. It's not that God's presence isn't there, like the Great Mother. God, well, they're the same thing, aren't they?
Mm.
It's everywhere. It pervades everything, and everything is its child, and everything is precious. Everything is precious, including the slugs and the mosquitoes. Utterly precious. But we cloud all our views of everything are so clouded, and these rituals are just to bring you back to a point of balance where miracles are normal. You know, there is no strangeness about a miracle if you're aligned, because the miracle is alignment.
Mm-hmm. I always wondered. I have spent some moments in my life considering the possibility that are miracles simply where our expectations are confounded?
Yes.
Because I do just absolutely meet the place so often where it seems to me the world is way, way, way more magical than we as a society are prepared to admit, and more interwoven, more interconnected, more possible, more things are possible than we collectively seem to be able to imagine. Like, I mean, wasn't it last time we were talking about our crazy transgender chickens? And that is a miracle really at its core, us having our eyes, our hearts, our souls opened to the extraordinariness of the, well, miraculousness, the wildness, the unbelievableness when you're a Westerner, of the crazy magic of creation.
Mm. Can I tell a story about the barracuda, the 7-foot barracuda?
Yeah, do.
After Henry died, my first husband, again, this is a series of miracles. Getting married to Henry is another miracle, but I'm going to drop that one because we haven't got the time. We'll go back to that another time. But that one-year marriage that changed my life completely, broke my duck in relationships, opened me up to what death was about cancer, about belief, about everything. That one-year marriage was a miracle from beginning to end. But when Henry died, I was devastated. I was still falling in love with him. I'd only known him 18 months when he died.
Mm.
And it was a particularly cruel death. He died from chemotherapy, vomited up his stomach, which was really not very nice. Not very nice. Anyway.
That's very English of you, Maggie.
Very nice. Well, being British and being the codependent, I sat there with my family afterwards, in the days before social distancing, and a friend of mine came round and I'd been saying, oh, it was a peaceful death, it was a peaceful death, because I was covering up, you know, I was making everybody else feel right. And there was a moment when they were out of the room, and I'll cry when I say this, and I said, oh, Sue, it wasn't peaceful at all. And she said, I know, darling, you're covered in blood.
Oh, God.
I had red hair. I never had red hair because I had Henry's blood all over my hair. Yeah. And when I had my shower that night, I saw his blood washing off me down the... But the miracle was, I went to Australia. I had two friends who, by a miracle, were travelling the world at that point on a sabbatical, and they were going to be in Cairns on the 27th of April. The 26th of April is my birthday. I couldn't face a birthday in the UK, so I ran away to Cairns. I had the money because Henry left me some money. And I arrived in Cairns, and the day before was my birthday, and the day before they arrived, in those days without mobile phones and the internet, it was a good thing we got within a week of each other. So I went out on the Barrier Reef, went snorkelling, because it was something to do. And I was so miserable and so unhappy, and I thought, you know, the beauty of it would be marvellous. And as we went out, they said on the ship, don't swim on the right-hand side of the boat. They use port and starboard, but I can't remember which is which now. The left-hand side is where the reef is. It's in the shallows. It's quite safe. Right-hand side is the deep water. This is Australia. It is not safe. 20 miles away from here, there has been a 7-foot barracuda and two divers are missing.
Oh, dear.
Do not swim that side of the boat. And everybody went into the water, splashing around. And if you've ever been really miserable, you know how other people's happiness really hacks you off. And everybody else was having a wonderful time, and I was just hating it. Couldn't get there at all. So I swam around the other side of the boat. And guess what was there?
7-foot barracuda, by the sounds of it.
There was a large fish in the water. I had an underwater camera. And I took a photograph of this fairly large fish that seemed to be quite a long way. Have you seen Father Ted? There's a bit with Father Dougal, who's the dim one, and Father Ted and Father Dougal in a caravan, and Father Ted's holding up a cow, one of those Britain's toy cows, and he's pointing at it and going, small. And then he points out of the window to some cows in a field, goes, far away, small, far away. Small, and Father Dougal just can't get it. Well, put it this way. I looked at that fish in the water and I thought, small, but interesting. Took a photograph, and I now know barracuda are attracted by brightness. And it was not small, it was far away.
Oh, God.
It saw the light, it saw me, and it came zigzagging really fast.
Dum, 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 dum.
Yeah. Absolutely. And up until that point, I hadn't wanted to commit suicide or anything, but I don't know if I'd have got out of the way of a bus. And I lay in that water, and I just, everything in my body went, but I want to live. And just that was the clarity that they'd sent the barracuda for, because they'd sent it 20 miles for me.
Yeah.
And a voice came into my head so clearly, not my words, not my voice, and it said, swim forward as fast as you can, make as much noise as you can, and if you get close enough, hit it on the nose with your fist.
Oh, goodness.
You know, which is, this is 30 years ago, it's totally counterintuitive. You can probably find on Google now all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't do that, or you should do that, or whatever. But there was no alternative. It had huge teeth. It was coming for me. I now know barracudas very rarely kill people, but they'll take a piece out of you so you'll drown.
Mm.
So I just went in the water and swam forward as fast as I could. And I got probably within about 6 foot of it. I can't tell because of the water, but very, very close. And it was enormous. And
were
I
you
was,
swimming at it?
Yes,
right away from it.
Swimming
Holy
at it.
Moly.
And it confused it.
I bet.
Because there was this water noise coming through the water and this thing was attacking it.
Yeah.
So it did this huge, great flip round and went sideways onto me at about 20 feet away and looked at, it was looking at me and it was going, what now? And I was basically going, what now? And the voice was so sweet and so resigned. It said, Maggie, you can swim back. I'd never even thought about swimming back, because I wasn't turning my back on it.
No way!
So I went, sort of breaststroke backwards, went back so fast I banged my foot on the side of the ship, and that really hurt, and that sort of woke me up. So I sort of went round the side of the ship, got out of the water, was sick, and just sat there shaking. I didn't tell anybody, because there was nobody else stupid enough to go round the side of the ship. But that was a miracle. It was
a series
of miracles.
Wow.
And I've got the photograph, and I'm glad I've got the photograph because I have it on my desktop on my computer. Remind me, you have outfaced a 7 foot barracuda with the help of God. Don't go into anything without the help of God again.
So that last statement leads me to a question that I've been meaning to ask you since the first time I heard your story about Henry. Which is that given that you are a woman who can say things like, you quite envy me my witchiness, and, you know, meant in the jokey and kindest of ways, but how on earth, what is it in you that means that you went back, that you go back to God, to Christianity, rather than going, screw you?
I'm going to answer that more next time, if I may, because we're on 42 minutes.
Oh, goodness, are we?
But in a nutshell, to mend it.
Beautiful.
I could walk away from the broken weave, or I could gird up my loins and say, I'm going in.
Yay, now that's a good note to end on.
See you next week.
Bye.